and all of her bank accounts, helping themselves to her credit while Leonard waited the requisite 6 months for Marty's estate to clear. The payoff there probably wasn't large, but added to Elaine Bolt's assets and the profits began to mount. Once Leonard had acquired sole possession of the property on Via Madrina, he could sell it off for $115,000. The lot was probably worth more with the house gone anyway. In the meantime, all he had to do was pose as the grief-stricken spouse, feigning disinterest in the proceeds. Not only did he garner sympathy, but he deflected attention from his true motivation, which was monetary from the get-go. The scheme might have gone off without a hitch, except that Beverly Danziger showed up, needing a routine signature on a minor document. Pat's claim about Elaine being off in Sarasota with friends simply wouldn't bear up under close scrutiny because Elaine's whereabouts couldn't really be accounted for. But how was I going to prove any of this? I was speculating like crazy, probably making a few wrong guesses here and there, but even if I had it right on the nose, I'd have to come up with some kind of concrete evidence to take to the police. In the meantime, Leonard had effectively blocked my path, putting me in check at least where the insurance company was concerned. I didn't dare go back and question him again, and I knew I'd better be careful about any inquiries I made in the world at large. Any line I pursued was going to be interpreted as slander, harassment, or defamation from his point of view. What had I gotten myself into? Leonard Grice and Pat Usher would have to stonewall my investigation, or the whole operation would come tumbling down around their ears. I stopped off at the hardware store to pick up a pane of glass, and then went back to my place. I had to find Elaine's passport. I checked the trash bags, behind couch cushions, under furniture, and all the other niches where I tend to tuck odds and ends. I didn't remember filing it, and it hadn't occurred to me to hide it. I knew I hadn't thrown it out, which meant it had to be here somewhere. I kept standing there, doing a 360-degree turn, surveying every corner of the room. Desktop, bookcase, coffee table, the small counter that separates the kitchenette. I went out to the car and looked in the glove compartment, map pocket, down behind the seat, sun visor, briefcase, jacket pocket, shit. I went back into my apartment and started all over again. Where had I put the damn thing? It might be at the office. I decided to try there after CF had closed up and Andy Montica had gone home. God, what did he know anyway? I was beginning to unravel the knots, and I only hoped I could finish before he got nervous and paid off the claim. I checked my watch. It was a little after 1, and I had the locksmith coming at 4. I sat down at my desk and hauled out my file on Elaine Bolt. Maybe there was something I'd overlooked. I baited my hook and started to cast about randomly. I felt like I'd been through my notes 100 times, and I couldn't believe anything new would surface. I went back and read every report I had. I tacked all my index cards to the bulletin board, first in order, then haphazardly, just to see if any contradictions would appear. I reread all the material Jonah had photocopied from the homicide files, and I studied glossy 8x10s of the murder scene until I knew every detail by heart. How had Marty been killed? A blunt instrument could mean just about anything. A lot of things were bothering me, minor questions buzzing around at the back of my brain like a swarm of gnats. I had begun to believe that if Elaine was dead, she'd been killed fairly early on. I had no proof yet, but I suspected that Pat Usher had masqueraded as Elaine and had staged that whole bogus departure for Florida as a sleight of hand, laying a false trail to create the illusion that Elaine was alive and well and on her way out of town, when in fact she was already dead. But if she'd been killed in Santa Teresa, where was the body? Disposing of a corpse is no mean feat. Fling one in the ocean and it swells up and floats right back. Toss it in the bushes and a jogger will stumble across it by 6 a.m. What else do you do with one? You bury it. Maybe the body was concealed in the Grice's basement. I remembered the floor down there, cracked concrete and hard-packed dirt, and I thought, now that might explain why Leonard had never had the salvage crew come in. When I'd first searched the Grice's house, I'd just been grateful for my good luck, but even at the time it had seemed almost too good to be true. Maybe Leonard didn't want the demolition experts knocking around down there. Pat Usher bothered me, too. Jonah hadn't had a chance to run a check on her through the National Crime Information Center because the computer had been down. By now he'd left for Idaho, but maybe I could have Spillman run the name for me to see what he could come up with. I didn't think Pat Usher was her real name, but it might show up an alias, if she had a criminal record, which was uncertain at this point. I took out a legal pad and made myself a note. Maybe with some judicious backtracking I could figure out who she was and how she'd gotten involved with Leonard Grice. I sorted through the new stack of Elaine's bills that Tilly had given me, tossing out the few pieces of junk mail. I came across an appointment reminder from a dentist in the neighborhood and tossed that aside. Elaine Bolt didn't drive, and I knew she patronized businesses within walking distance of her condominium. I remembered in the first batch of bills I'd seen there was a bill from the same dentist, John Pickett, DDS Incorporated. Where else had I run into him? I leafed back through the material from the homicide file, running my eye down each page. Ah, no wonder the name rang a bell. He was the dentist who supplied the full mouth x-rays used to identify Marty Grice. There was a knock at the door, and I looked up, startled. It was already 4 o'clock. I glanced out through the little fisheye peephole and opened the door. The locksmith was young, maybe 22. She flashed me a smile that featured nice white teeth. Oh, hi, she said. I'm Becky. Is this the right place? I tried up front, and the old guy said I probably wanted you. Yeah, that's right, I said. Come on in. She was taller than I and very thin, with long bare arms and blue jeans that hung on her narrow hips. She had a carpenter's belt slung around her waist, a hammer hanging down like a gun in a holster. Her fair hair was cut short with a boyish cowlick across the front. Freckles, blue eyes, pale lashes, no makeup, all the gawkiness of an adolescent. She had an athlete's no-nonsense good looks, and she smelled of ivory soap. I moved toward the bathroom. The window's in here. I want some kind of heavy-duty hardware installed that can't be breached. Her eyes lit up when she saw the cut in the glass. Gee, not bad. Slick job, huh? You want to put new locks on the other windows or just this? I want new locks on everything, including my desk. Can you rekey the deadbolt? Sure, I can do anything you want. If you got glass, I'll reglaze the window for you, too. I love doing things like that. I left her to install the heavy-duty hardware. Belatedly, I snatched up several articles of dirty clothing strewn about my living room. There's nothing like an outsider's idle glance to make you conscious of your own environment. I chucked 2 beach towels, a sweatshirt, and a dark cotton sundress on top of some other stuff in the washing machine. I tend to use my washer as a dirty clothes hamper anyway, since I'm pinched for space. I tossed in a cup of detergent. I cranked the dial around to permanent press, just to keep the cycle short, and I was on the verge of popping the door shut again when I spotted Elaine's passport poking up out of the back pocket of a pair of blue jeans. I think I must have hooted my surprise, because Becky stuck her head out of the bathroom door. Did you call me? No, that's all right. I just found something I'd been looking for. Oh, okay. Good for you. She went back to work. I put the passport at the back of my bottom desk drawer and locked it. Thank God I have the passport, I thought. Thank God it had turned up. It was like a talisman, a good omen. Cheered, I decided I might as well type up my notes, so I hauled out my little portable typewriter and set it up. I could hear Becky thumping around with the window, and after a few minutes she stuck her head out of the bathroom again. Hey, Kinsey, this thing is all gimmicked up. You want me to fix it? Sure, why not, I said. If you get the window to work right, I've got some other things you can take care of, too. Hey, great, she said, and disappeared again. I could hear a big wrenching noise as she pried the window frame away. It was worrisome, all that pep and enthusiasm. I thought I heard something crack. Don't worry about the noise, she called out. I saw my dad do this once, and it's a snap. After a moment, she passed through the room, tiptoeing elaborately, finger to her lips. Sorry to disturb your work. I have to go out to the truck and get some line. You go right ahead, she murmured. She was speaking in a hoarse whisper as though it would be less intrusive if she used a softer tone. I rolled my eyes heavenward and went on typing. 3 minutes later, she came back to the front door and tapped. I had to get up to let her in. She apologized again briefly and went back into the bathroom where she settled in. I did a cover letter for Julia and caught up with my accounting. Becky was in the other room going bang, bang, bang with her trusty hammer. After a few minutes, she appeared again. All done. Want to come try it? Just a minute, I said. I finished typing the envelope and got up, moving into the bathroom. I wondered if this was what it felt like to have a little kid around the house. Noise, interruptions, the constant bid for attention. Even the average mother amazes me. God, what fortitude! Look at this, she said happily. She raised the window. Before, it had been like lifting a 50-pound weight. It would stick midway and then shriek, flying up unexpectedly, glass nearly cracking as it whacked into the frame. To lower the window, I practically had to hang by my hands, humping it down inch by inch. Most of the time, I just left it shut. Now it's lit up without a hitch. She stepped back so I could try it. I reached over and lowered it, apparently unprepared for the improvement because the window dropped so fast it made the window weights thump against the studs in the wall. Becky laughed. I told you it worked. I was staring from her to the window frame. Two ideas had popped into my head simultaneously. I was thinking about Dr. Pickett and the dental x-rays, and about May Snyder's claim that she heard someone going bang, bang, bang the night Marty died. I have to go someplace, I said. Are you nearly done? She laughed again, that uneasy false merriment that burbles out when you think you're dealing with someone who's come unhinged. Well, no, I thought you said you had other things you wanted me to do. Tomorrow, or maybe the next day, I said. I was moving her toward the door, reaching for my handbag. Becky allowed herself to be pushed along. Did I say something? She asked. We'll talk about it tomorrow, I said. I really appreciate your help. I drove back to Elaine Bolt's neighborhood and circled the block, looking for Dr. Pickett's office on Arbol. I'd seen it before, one of those one-story clapboard cottages once so prevalent in the neighborhood. Most of them had been converted into branch offices for real estate companies and antique stores that looked like someone's tiny, crowded living space with a sign hung out front. Dr. Pickett had paved over some flower beds to create a little parking lot. There was only one car out back, a 1972 Buick with a vanity plate that read, F-A-L-S-T-T-H. False Tith. I pulled in beside it and locked my car, moving around the front and up to the porch. The sign on the door said, Please walk in. So I did. The interior felt distinctly like my old grade school, varnished wood floors and the smell of vegetable soup. I could hear someone clattering around out in the kitchen. There was a radio on out there, tuned to a country music station. A scarred wooden desk was angled across the entry hall with a little bell and a sign that said, Please ring for service. I tapped on the bell. To my right was a waiting room with Danish modern plastic couches and low tables done in wood laminate. The magazines were lined up precisely, but I suspected the subscriptions had run out. I spotted an issue of Life with Starlet Janice Rule on the front. A partition had been put up between the reception area and Dr. Pickett's examining room. Through the open door, I caught sight of an old-fashioned dental chair with a black plastic seat and a white porcelain spitting sink. The instrument tray was round and apparently swiveled on a metal arm. The surface was protected with white paper, like a placemat, and the instruments were lined up on it like something out of a dental museum. I was certainly thrilled that I didn't need my teeth cleaned right then. To my left, along the wall, were some battered wooden file cabinets, unattended. I could hear the devil call out to me. Dutifully, I rang the bell again, but the country music wailed right on. I knew the tune, and the lyrics routinely broke my heart. There were little brass frames on the front of each file cabinet into which hand-lettered white cards had been slipped. A to C read the first. D to F read the next. You can't lock those old files, you know. Well, sometimes you can, but not these. I was going to have to go through such a long song and dance, too, I thought, and I might be on the wrong track, which would just waste everybody's time, including my own. I only hesitated because the courts are real fussy about the integrity of evidence. You're not supposed to run around stealing information that you later hope to offer up as prosecution's exhibits A and B. The cops are supposed to acquire all that stuff, tag it, initial it, and keep meticulous records about who's had access to it and where it's been. Chain of evidence, it's called. I mean, I read all this stuff, and I know. I called, Yoo-hoo, and waited, wondering if Yoo-hoo, like Mama and Dada, was one of those phrases that crop up in most languages. If nobody responded in the next 10 seconds, I was going to cheat. Chapter 24 Mrs. Dr. Pickett appeared. At least I assumed it was she. She was stout, with a big round face, rimless glasses, and a soft pug nose. The dress she wore was a navy blue nylon jersey with a print of tiny white arrows flying off in all directions. Her hair was pulled up to the top of her head and secured with a rubber band, curls cascading as though from a little fountain. She had on a wide white apron with a bib front, and she smoothed the lap of the fabric down self-consciously. "Well, now, I thought I heard someone out here, but I don't believe I know your name," she said. Her voice was honeyed, tinted with faint southern overtones. I had one split second in which to decide whether to tell the truth. I held my hand out and gave her my name. "I'm a private detective," I said. Is that right? She said, wide-eyed. What in the world can I do for you? Well, I'm not sure yet, I said. Are you Mrs. Pickett? Yes, I am, she said. I hope you're not investigating John. Her voice rode up and down musically, infused with drama. I shook my head. I'm looking into the death of a woman who lived here in the neighborhood. And I bet you're talking about Marty Grice. That's right, I said. Aw, and wasn't that the awfulest thing? I can't tell you how upset I was when I heard about that. Nice woman like her to meet up with such a fate. But now, isn't that just the way? Terrible, I said. And you know what? They never did catch whoever did it. She was a patient of Dr. Pickett's, wasn't she? She sure was, and a sweeter person you couldn't hope to meet. You know she used to stop in here all the time. She'd sit right there, and we'd have us chat. When my arthritis was acting up, she'd help out with the phones and whatnot. I never saw John so upset as when we had to go out there and identify the remains. I don't believe he slept for a week. Was he the one who took the dental x-rays during the autopsy? The pathologist did that. John hand-carried the x-rays he'd done in the office, and they compared 'em right on the spot. There wasn't any doubt, of course. It was just a formality, is what they told us. He'd taken those x-rays not 6 weeks before she died. I felt so sorry for that husband of hers, I just thought I'd choke. We went over to the funeral, too, you know, and I made the awfulest fool of myself that ever was. Cried like a baby, and John did, too. Oh, but now he's the one you want to talk to, I'm sure. This is his day off, but he should be home soon. He's out running some errands. You can wait if you like, or come back later on. You can probably help me as well as he could, I said. Well, I'll do what I can, she said dubiously. I'm no expert, but I've assisted him all our married life. He's often said I could probably fill a tooth as well as he could, but now I don't like that Novocaine. I won't fool with needles. It makes my hands turn to ice, and I get all goosebumpy on my arms. She rubbed her arms, giving a mock shiver to illustrate how upsetting it was. Anyway, you go on and ask what you want. I don't mean to interrupt. I understand Dr. Pickett had a patient named Elaine Bolt, I said. Could you check your records and tell me when she came in last? The name sounds familiar, but I can't say I know her offhand. She wouldn't be anyone regular, I will say that, because I'd know her if she'd been here more than once. She leaned closer to me. I don't suppose you're allowed to tell me how this applies, she said in a confidential tone. No, I'm not, I said, but they were friends. Mrs. Bolt lived right next door to Mrs. Grice. Mrs. Pickett nodded slightly, giving her eyebrows a lift as though she got the drift and wouldn't repeat a word of it. She went over to the file cabinets and pulled open the top drawer. I was right next to her. I wondered if she'd mind my looking over her shoulder, but she didn't seem to object. The drawer was packed so tightly she could barely squeeze her fingers in. She started reciting the names on the tags. Let's see. Bassage, Berlin, Bewley, Beavis. Uh-oh, look a-here now. That's out of place, she said. She switched the two files around and started where she'd left off. Birch, Blackmar, Blunt. I have Bowles. Is that the name you gave? No, Bolt, I said. B-O-L-D-T. I know you billed her once, and I just saw a reminder for a 6-month checkup. I believe you're right. I wrote that recall card myself, and I remember now. Via Madrina, wasn't it? She looked back into the file drawer, checking a few folders forward and a few folders back. I bet you for some reason he's got that on his desk, she said. You come on in here and we'll take a look. I followed her down a short hallway and into a small office on the left that had probably once been a powder room. Dr. Pickett's desk was stacked with files, and his wife put her hands on her hips as though she'd never laid eyes on such a sight. Oh, my stars! Now, if that's not a mess, she began to check through the nearest pile. Why would he have it on his desk? I asked. We might have had a request for dental records, is all I can think of, she said. Sometimes patients transfer out of state. You want me to help? I sure do, hon. This might take all day at this rate. I pitched in, riffling through the stack nearest me, then rechecking the pile she'd done to make sure she hadn't overlooked anything. There was no Elaine Bolt. I got one more place, she said. She held a finger up and marched us back to the front desk, where she opened the top desk drawer and reached for a small gray metal file box. This is the recall file. If she got a notice, she'd be in this box. I don't guess she gave any hint when she might have been in. Nope, I said. I'd guess December, though, if she just got a 6 months' notice. Mrs. Pickett gave me an appreciative glance. Good point. I guess that's why you're a detective instead of me. All right, let's see what December looks like. She sorted through about 15 cards. Already I was worried about Dr. Pickett's annual income if he saw fewer patients than one a day. Light month, I remarked, watching her. He's semi-retired, she said, absorbed in her hunt. He still takes care of these old people in the neighborhood, but he tries to limit his practice. He's got varicose veins worse than me, and his doctor doesn't want him on his feet all day. We get out and walk every chance we get. Keeps the circulation up. Here it is. She held an index card up, handing it to me with a mixture of triumph and relief. They might be near retirement age, but the office was still well run. I studied the card. All it had on it was Elaine Bolt's name and address and the date she'd been in, December 28th. Was I on the right track? I turned the notion over in my mind. Marty Grice would have come in first, I said, and then recommended Dr. Pickett to Elaine. That's not hard to verify, Mrs. Pickett said. See, on the back of the card, I have that line says, referred by, and here's Mrs. Grice's name sure enough. Actually, we do that so if folks skip out on their bill, we have some way to trace back. Could I see Marty's chart, I asked. Well, I don't see why not. She went back to the file cabinet and pulled a slim folder out of the drawer marked G to I and passed it to me. Marty's name was neatly typed across the tag on the top. I opened the file. There were three sheets inside. The first was a medical questionnaire, asking for information about medications, known allergies, and past illnesses. Marty had completed the form and signed it, automatically authorizing all necessary dental services. The second was a dental history inquiring about root canals, bleeding gums, occasional bad breath, and grinding or clenching of teeth. The third sheet contained information about treatment actually rendered, with a line drawing of the top and bottom rows of teeth laid out like a Mercator projection. Current fillings marked in ballpoint pen. Marty's name was neatly typed on the top line. Below were Dr. Pickett's brief handwritten notes. A routine visit. She'd had her teeth cleaned. There were apparently no dental caries. X-rays had been done and she was scheduled to return in June. I stared at it for a long time, running the whole sequence of events through my head. Everything seemed to be in order except for the date. December 28th. I moved over to the window and held the chart to the light. I could feel a chill smile forming, because somehow I'd known it would come down like that. I just hadn't believed I would actually find the proof. Yet here it was. Someone had neatly whited out the name originally typed in, and typed Marty's name right over it. I ran my finger across the top line, feeling for the name typed underneath as though it were done in Braille. Elaine Bolt's name was visible as a faint imprint under the name Marty Grice. The last few pieces were falling into place. I was certain hers were the charred remains recovered from the Grice's house that night. I closed my eyes. It suddenly seemed very strange. I'd been tracking Elaine for 10 days without realizing I'd already seen her in a photograph in the homicide file, burned beyond recognition. Marty Grice was alive, and I suspected that she and Pat Usher were one and the same. There were details to nail down yet, but I had a very good idea how the murder had been set up. "Are you feeling all right?" "I'm fine," I said briefly. "Do you want to talk to John?" "Not right now, but at some point, yes. You've been a big help, Mrs. Pickett, thanks." "Well, I don't know what I did, but you're certainly welcome." I shook her hand, dimly aware of the mystified gaze that followed me as I left. I got in my car and sat there, trying to figure out what to do next. Jesus, how had they assured that the stomach contents would match? That must have been a slick one. The autopsy report indicated the blood type was O positive, the most common type, so that was easy enough. Marty and Elaine were close in height. It wasn't as though the murder victim was completely unknown. Everyone assumed it was Marty, and the dental X-rays had simply been used to confirm her identity. There was no reason to imagine that the dead woman was anyone else. Leonard and his sister had talked to her on the phone at 9, and Lily claimed Marty had hung up to go answer the door. The call to the police station was a little flourish someone thought up for effect. Mike was right about the time. At 8:30 that night, there was a woman's body wrapped up in a rug. It just wasn't his aunt. Elaine must have been bludgeoned to death some time earlier, with enough of her jaw and teeth left intact to make identification possible. So many things were suddenly falling into place. Wim Hoover must have recognized Marty going in or out of Elaine's apartment. Marty or Leonard apparently got to him before he got to a phone. I started the car and pulled out of the lot, turning left. I headed over to the police station and parked out front in a 15-minute green zone across the street. Once inside the station, I stopped at the counter on the left. Beyond the counter, there was a doorway leading back into the squad room. Some cop in plain clothes I'd never laid eyes on spotted me standing there as he passed the door. He paused.
"You need some help?"
"I'm looking for Lieutenant Dolan."
"Let me check. I was just back there and I didn't see him."
He disappeared. I waited, glancing over my shoulder into identifications and records.
The black clerk was the only one there, and she was typing away like crazy. I kept going back over it in my mind. It was so clear now how it all fit. Marty Grice had gone to Florida and lived in Elaine's apartment. It wasn't hard to figure out what she'd done. Lost some weight, had her hair restyled and dyed. No one down there knew her from Adam, so it wasn't as if she had to hide. She probably just got herself spiffed up once she had Elaine's bucks to do it with. I thought back to my encounter with her. The bruised, puffy face, the tape across her nose. She hadn't been in any automobile accident. She'd had cosmetic surgery. A new face to go along with her new identity. She told me herself that she was retired and didn't expect to work another day in her life. She and Leonard had fallen on hard times, and there sat Elaine Bolt with money to burn and a tendency to indulge herself. How Marty must have seethed at the sight. Murder had been an equalizing force, with grand larceny providing a pension fund after the fact. Now all she had to do was wait until Leonard freed up and the two were set. It was Dolan's case. If the murder weapon turned up, I thought he'd have enough evidence to act on. For now, at least, I could tell him what was happening. I didn't think it was smart to keep it to myself. The plainclothesman returned.
"He's gone for the day. Is there something I can help you with?"
"Gone," I said. I bit back my customary expletive, but inside my head I was saying, "Shit!"
"I'll be in touch first thing in the morning."
"Sure. You want to leave him a note?"
I took one of my cards out and gave it to him. "Just tell him I'll stop by and fill him in."
"Will do," he said.
I went back to my car and took off. I had a theory about where the murder weapon was, but I wanted to talk to Lily Howe first. If she'd figured out what was going on, she'd be in danger. I glanced down at my watch. It was 6:15. I spotted a payphone at a gas station and pulled in. My heart had begun to thud with dread. I didn't want Mike in jeopardy. If he realized his aunt was alive, he'd be in trouble, too. Hell, we all were. My hands were trembling as I paged through the telephone book, feverishly scanning for the other Grice listings. I found a Horace Grice on Anaconda, which looked like a good bet, and then had to scramble around in the bottom of my handbag for 20 cents. I dialed, holding my breath, while the phone rang once, twice, four times, six. I let 12 rings go by, and then I put the receiver back. I ripped the page out of the phone book and shoved it into my bag, hoping I'd have an opportunity to call again. I got back in my car and headed out to Lily Howe's place. Where were Leonard and Marty at this point? Could they have skipped, or was it possible they were still together somewhere in town? At Lily Howe's, perhaps? I missed Carolina Avenue and had to circle back, peering at house numbers as I passed. I spotted the Howe's residence and slowed, much to the annoyance of the people in the car behind me. I drove on by and did a turnaround in a driveway 6 doors down. As I pulled into the curb to park, my heart gave a lurch. Leonard and his lady friend had just pulled into Lily's drive. I slouched down in my seat abruptly, banging one knee on the dashboard. Oh, jeez, that hurt. I eased up slightly, peering over the edge of the steering wheel. They apparently hadn't paid any attention to me because they were both getting out of the car, moving toward Lily's front door with nary a backward glance. They knocked, and she opened the door for them without any exclamation of surprise, horror, shock, or dismay. I wondered how long she'd known that Marty was alive. Had she been in league with them from the beginning? I watched the house uneasily. As long as Leonard was there, I was reasonably certain that Lily was safe, but I didn't think Marty would be at all inclined to leave Lily Howe alive when they went off. I was going to have to do a little hovering over Lily Howe, playing guardian angel to her, whether she knew it or not. Chapter 25. I sat there while an incredibly painful, probably permanent bruise formed on my knee, trying to figure out what I should do next. I didn't want to leave the scene now that I had the enemy in range. There wasn't a public phone within miles, and who was I going to call anyway? I thought about getting out of the car and creeping up to the house, but I've never had very good results with that sort of thing. There are never windows open where you want them to be. On the few occasions when I've managed to eavesdrop, the subject matter has always been irrelevant. People just don't sit around verbalizing the pertinent details of recent crimes. Peer over a windowsill, and chances are you're going to watch the villains play crazy eights. I've never seen anyone dismember the body or divvy up the bank heist. I decided to stay in my car and wait. There's nothing as conspicuous as someone sitting alone in a parked car in a residential neighborhood. With any luck, some worried homeowner would spot me and call the cops, and then I could have a nice chat with someone in uniform. Mentally, I organized a condensed version of the murder plot so I could tell it succinctly when the time came. The house was quiet. An hour and 45 minutes passed, and the gathering darkness gradually reduced visibility to mush.
Lights and houses all up and down the street came on, including Lily Howe's. Somebody sprayed the neighborhood with barbecue cologne. I was hungry, and I wanted to take a leak, and I couldn't decide if I should risk squatting down behind someone's bushes. I don't feel I suffer from penis envy, but in moments like this I do yearn for the anatomical advantages. At 9:23, Lily's front door opened, and Leonard and Marty came out. I leaned forward, squinting. There weren't any lingering farewells. The two of them got in the car, slammed the doors, and backed out of the drive. I waited until their car had disappeared, and then approached the house. The porch light had gone off. I knocked. There was a moment of silence, and then I heard the chain slide into place. Lily had read all the manuals on rape prevention. Good for her. "Who is it?" came the muffled voice from inside. I reduced my voice to a whisper. "It's me. I forgot my handbag." The burglar chain slid back, and Lily opened the door a crack. I pushed forward so fast the door almost broke her nose. There was a clunk, and she cried out, but by then I'd closed the door behind me again. "We have to talk," I said. She had a hand to her face, and tears had risen in her eyes, not because of any damage I'd done, but because she was upset to begin with.
"She said she'd kill me if I said anything."
"She's going to kill you anyway, you twit. What do you think, she's going to walk off and leave you around to spill the beans? Did she tell you what she did to Wim Hoover? She put a bullet right behind his ear. You're dog meat. You don't stand a chance." Lily paled. A sob broke the surface like a bubble of air from the bottom of a pond, but then she seemed to collect herself. She closed her eyes and shook her head like a prisoner faced with the rack. She didn't care what I did to her. She was not going to talk. "God damn it, tell me what's going on." Her expression hardened, and I got a sudden glimpse of what she must have been like as a kid. Leonard's sister knew how to deal with bullies like me. She became stubborn, passive, a defensive stance she'd apparently perfected over the years as a way of warding off attack. She simply withdrew, pulling in on herself like a mollusk. She must have been threatened routinely as a child with everything from tetanus shots if she didn't wash her hands every time she peed, to a police arrest if she didn't look both ways before she crossed the street. Instead of learning the rules, she'd learned to disappear. To my amazement, she crossed to one of the turquoise chairs and sat down without another word. She picked up the remote control and flicked the television on, moving through six channels until she found a sitcom she liked. She was going to tune me out. I went over to the chair and hunkered beside her, talking earnestly while she kept her face to the screen. She watched intently as a buxom platinum blonde in a tank top proceeded to put together a birthday cake. "Mrs. Howe, I'm not sure you understand what's going on here. Your sister-in-law has killed two people, and no one seems to be aware of it but us." Flour puffed up in a big cloud, obscuring the blonde's baby face. Befuddled, she'd apparently used baking powder and yeast, causing the dry flour to explode. The laugh track was cranked up to hilarious. Oh, that gal, wasn't she a screech? Lily smiled faintly, reminded perhaps of baking disasters of her own. I touched her arm. "We're running out of time, Lil, because know what? I think Marty Grice is going to double back and kill us, too. She'll have to." No response. Maybe what I said had no more reality for her than this bimbo with the birthday cake. She was cracking eggs now, getting splatted in the face with yolks. Simple laws of nature were being violated here, and she was the butt of the joke. In walked the husband. His mouth fell open at the mess she'd made. New paroxysms of laughter erupted. I wondered if anything in the real world had ever struck me with such force. I said, "Where did they go just now? Are they leaving town?" Lily laughed aloud. The blonde had turned the mixing bowl upside down on her husband's head. She showed him. A few bars of the show's dizzy theme song played, and the station cut away to the commercial. I reached over and pressed the volume button, extinguishing the sound. In silence, a dog skidded across the linoleum with a can of chopped liver in pursuit. "Hey," I said, "Leonard's in trouble. Are you going to help him or not?" She glanced over at me, and I saw her lips move. I leaned closer. "Excuse me, what?" The strain was showing in her face, and her eyes seemed unfocused. She watched me with all the concentration of a drunk, dependent and out of control. "Leonard never hurt anyone," she said. "He had no idea what she was doing till it was too late." I thought about Mike's report of Leonard's passion for his wife. I didn't see him as an innocent victim in all of this, but I kept my big mouth shut. "As long as he knows anything, he's in danger. If you'll tell me where they're going, I can get him out of it." She spoke in a whisper. "Just to Los Angeles, till the new passport for Marty comes through, and then they're flying to South America." Her eyes filled with tears.
"I might never see him again," she said. "And we were always so close. I can't turn him in. I can't betray him, don't you see?"
"You're trying to do what's best for him, Lily. He'll understand."
It's been awful. It's been a nightmare. When you showed up, I thought he'd die of fright. He nearly had a heart attack, and that's when she came back. She thinks you took Elaine's passport, and she's furious at the delay. He's afraid of her. He's always been frightened by the fits she throws.
Of course he has. I'm afraid of her myself. She's nuts. Do they have the bags in the car with them?
She was breaking down now, caving in. The notion of Leonard's desertion caused too much pain, and the image of packed suitcases cracked her heart. It was all too much. What difference did any of it make now that he was leaving her?
"They've gone off to pack," she said.
Her voice came out in a gasp, and her nose had started to run. "That's where they went, the motel out by the pass, and then the house. They fought about it, but she wouldn't leave it behind because it was evidence."
"Leave what?"
The
"The murder weapon?" Lily nodded and nodded again. I didn't think she could stop. It was as if the cords in her neck had come loose and her head was destined to wag indefinitely. She looked like one of those bobblehead dogs people have perched up in the back windows of their cars.
"Lily, listen to me. I want you to call the police. Go to a neighbor's house and stay there until somebody comes. Do you understand? Come on, do you need anything? A sweater? A handbag?" I wanted to scream at her to hurry, but I didn't dare.
She was looking at me with washed-out, worried blue eyes, her gaze as trusting as a dog's. I got her to her feet and flipped the TV off, and then bundled her out the front. I scanned the street, but there was no one in sight. I couldn't believe Leonard would let Marty hurt her, but we all knew who was in charge. In some ways, I felt as if I was wasting time, but I had to make sure Lily Howe was safe. We went up to the first house that showed a light, a cedar shingle place 2 doors down. I rang the bell. Some man opened the door, and I pushed her forward, explaining that there was trouble and she needed some help. I urged Lily to call the cops, and then I left. I wasn't sure if she'd do it or not. I got in my car and squealed out, burning rubber as I skidded around the corner 2 blocks down. I drove tensely, sliding through stop signs, bypassing traffic any way I could. I had to get to the house before they did. I got stuck at a light and used the time to paw through my glove compartment, looking for the flashlight. I pulled it out and checked the batteries. They seemed fine. The signal changed to green, and I took off again. Belatedly, I realized my gun was still locked in the file cabinet at the office. I nearly slammed the brakes on and went back for it, but I didn't have time. If they went to the motel first, packed, checked out, and loaded the car up, I might have time to get the murder weapon before they did. If they beat me to the punch, I was going to head straight for Tilly's and call the police. I had no intention of taking on Marty Grice all by myself. I could feel a big rush of adrenaline, and my neurons fired up, completing a circuit with a joyous leap. An answer to an old question popped into my head, and I suddenly knew how they'd maneuvered the stomach contents. Marty had stolen Elaine's kitchen trash. It wasn't any more complicated than that. The brown grocery bag Mike had seen in the hall was Elaine Bolt's garbage, containing the empty tuna can and the soup can that comprised her supper that night. Marty had had hours to set it up, and I could visualize the scenario as though I had powers of clairvoyance. Leonard went out to dinner with Lily, and Marty gave Elaine a call, inviting her over on some casual pretext. Elaine stopped by and at some point was bashed in the face until dead. Marty took the keys and went over to Elaine's as soon as it was dark. She retrieved the kitchen garbage and took it back to her house, leaving it in the hall for a minute while she went down to the basement for the kerosene. That's when Mike had appeared, opening the front door and closing it again when he realized that something was desperately wrong. Marty finished dousing the place with kerosene and sat back to wait for Leonard's prearranged call at 9, reporting by phone what Elaine had eaten so he could later mention it to the police, a tuna sandwich and tomato soup. Maybe Marty stuck the leftovers on her own refrigerator shelf so it would all tally up and look legitimate. Marty set the fire and then slipped over to Elaine's, where she holed up in comfort until her flight to Florida the following Monday night. My guess was that she dyed her hair before she left, and I suspected that the fine clump of gray-brown hair I'd seen in Elaine's bathroom wastebasket during my initial search there was in fact additional evidence that Marty Grice had been there. I reached the Grice's house and pulled up across the street, taking a moment to study the house and yard. In the darkness, the fire damage was hidden, but the place still exuded that aura of ruin and abandonment. There was no sign of the car out front, no lights anywhere in the house, no pedestrians on the street. I turned off the ignition and got out of the car, leaving the door ajar. I wanted to be able to ease back in and take off without a lot of fumbling around if it came to that. I opened the trunk and took out the tools I thought I'd need. As soon as I determined that nobody was coming, I crossed the street and cut through the Grice's side yard. I moved quietly along the walk, surveying windows as I passed. Most of the windows at the front of the house had been broken out by the fire and boarded back up again, but there were 2 near the back of the house that were still intact. I chose one and jimmied it open. It was pitch black, and the neighborhood was quiet except for crickets chirring in the grass. I knew I should give myself an escape route, but I couldn't take the chance. If the two of them showed up, they'd spot any open windows or doors. I'd just have to work fast and hope my guess about the murder weapon was correct. I didn't have time for mistakes. I climbed into the kitchen and pulled the window shut. The floor crackled with broken glass as I passed through. My flashlight streaked across blackened door frames, smoke-tinged walls, into a hallway dense with shadow. I held my breath, listening. The silence was flat, one-dimensional. The electricity was turned off, and I missed the soft hum of machinery. No refrigerator, no furnace, no wall clock, no water heater ticking from the other room. Some vague phrase about the silence of the tomb came to mind, but I pushed it away. I moved forward, startled as a shard of glass popped underfoot. Was someone moving around upstairs? I swung the light across the ceiling, half expecting footsteps to appear up there like visible dents. The imagination has primitive, cartoon-like qualities, as any child can testify. I moved again. There was some illumination farther on, a pale light spilling in from the house next door. I paused at the window that looked directly into the living room across the way. Mr. Snyder was watching a television show, images flickering silently. The only other window on this side of the house was a small one just off the kitchen near the rear. I had a theory now about the banging May Snyder heard that night, and I was about to test it out. I glanced toward the room where she slept, but it was already dark. I wondered if that's what old age is about, sleeping longer and longer hours until one day you simply don't bother to wake. I ran my fingers along the window frame, shining the light across the fire-warped paint, a shriveled and puckered white like dead skin. I could see where the wood had been damaged before. I could see where it had been secured with nails again. Bang, bang, bang. I propped the flashlight on the windowsill. It took me a few minutes to get the flashlight angled properly so I could see what I was doing and still have both hands free to work. I edged the narrow curve of the crowbar into the window frame and pried it loose with a crack so deafening it made my heart skip. I believed Elaine had been killed with a sash weight that had been tucked back in the window frame and nailed into place. The motion had come to me in one of those flashes of insight when I heard the weights in my own bathroom window thump dully against the studs. It was nice. It had a certain domestic tidiness about it that Marty must have liked. If the house had burned down entirely that night, then who would have ever figured it out? The bulldozers would have mowed down what was left of the house, rubble loaded into high-siders, hauled off to the dump. Even now, even as it was, who was going to know? In a way, she was foolish to come back for it. Why not just leave it where it was? She was being pushed into a panic, probably anxious to tie up loose ends, so that she could feel safe wherever she went. They might catch her, but what could they prove? The murder weapon probably had her prints all over it. Maybe it still bore strands of Elaine's hair, or fragments of broken teeth and bones, microscopic particles of flesh. I wondered what she planned to do with the grisly thing. Bury it somewhere, perhaps? Toss it off the end of a pier? I jammed a big screwdriver into the tight crack between the framing and the strip of wood that held it in place. Window parts must have names, I thought, but I didn't know what they were. I was just imitating Becky's carpentry. The result was the same. I had the frame dismantled, exposing both sets of weights, the cord connecting them, and the pulleys that regulated the raising and lowering of the sash. I hauled both sets into view, four weights altogether, careful not to touch anything. Shit, prints weren't going to show up on these things. The metal was covered with a thin film of sawdust and grime. Moisture in the wall had generated so much rust that any latent prints had probably been obliterated now. It wasn't going to help that 6 months had passed. Flecks of dried blood would still show up on a microscopic exam, but I wasn't sure what else. I shone the flashlight along the sash. At the tip were two glinting blonde hairs caught in a knot of dark brown. I could feel my lips purse with distaste. I eased a small plastic baggie over the tip and secured it with tape. I advanced the blade in the utility knife I'd brought with me and slashed through the cords, clanging the weights together inadvertently as I lowered them into a big plastic bag. Lieutenant Dolan and his trusty crime scene crew would have fits if they saw me manhandling evidence this way, but I didn't have any choice. I tossed the utility knife in the plastic bag along with the rest of my tools, plastic rustling with my every move, which is why I didn't hear Leonard and Marty until they had already reached the back steps. Chapter 26. The Last Chapter. The key rattled in the lock and my head whipped up. Fear shot through me like a jolt of electricity, and my heart started thudding so hard it made my whole neck pulse. My single advantage was that I knew about them before they knew about me. I snatched up the flashlight, tucking the plastic-wrapped packet of weights under my arm. I was already on the move, assessing my options with a brain that felt slow and cold, as though plunged in an icy surf. My temptation was to head up to the second floor, but I scotched the impulse. There was no cover up there, and no access to the roof.
I eased to my left toward the kitchen, my hearing open to the full. I could pick up low conversational tones out there. They were probably trying to get their bearings, just shining a flashlight here and there. If Marty hadn't been in the house since the night of the fire, she might be reacting to the damage, momentarily repelled as I had been by the charring, decay, and ruin. They hadn't figured it out yet, but soon they would. The minute they saw that window frame, they'd start looking for me. The basement door was ajar, a vertical black slot against the gloom of the hallway. I allowed myself one flicker of light from the flashlight and slipped through the crack, descending as quickly as I could without making noise. I knew the slanted basement doors leading out to the side yard were padlocked shut, but at least I'd find some place to hide down there. I hoped. Down I went, pausing at the bottom of the stairs so that I could orient myself. Above me I heard the snap and crunch of footsteps. It was pitch bloody black where I was. It felt like the darkness was lying on the surface of my eyes, a thick black mask that no light could penetrate. I had to risk the flashlight again. Even after so short a time, I felt myself recoil from the glare, turning my head abruptly to shield my eyes. I blinked, willing my eyes to adapt. Oh, God, how was I going to get out of this? I did a quick search, raking the beam in a 360-degree arc. I had to hide the sash weights, and there wasn't much time. They might catch me, but I didn't want them to get their hands on the murder weapon, which is exactly what they'd come to fetch. I crossed to the furnace, which stood massive and dead, looking somehow as ominous as a tank down there. I eased the door open and shoved the weights in, jamming the packet down between the outer wall and the housing for the gas jets. The hinge gave a harsh shriek as I pushed the door shut. I froze, glancing up automatically as though I might make a visual assessment of how far the sound had carried. Silence overhead. They had to be in the hall by now, had to have seen the damage I'd left. Now they were listening for me as I listened for them. In the dark of an old house like this, sound can be as deceptive as the voice of a ventriloquist. Frantically, I scanned for some place to hide. Every nook and cranny I spotted was too small or too shallow to do me any good. Overhead, a floorboard creaked. It wasn't going to take them long. There were two of them. They'd split up. One would go upstairs and one would come down. I cut left, tiptoeing across the basement to the short concrete stairwell that led to the outside world. I crouched and crept upward, squeezing into the narrow space at the top. My hunched back was right up against the wood doors, my legs drawn up under me. With the electricity shut down in the house, they'd be forced to search by flashlight, and maybe they'd miss me. I hoped I'd be hard to spot wedged up in here, but I couldn't be sure. In the meantime, the only thing that separated me from freedom was that slanted expanse of wood at my back. I could smell the damp night air through the cracks. The sweet scent of the jasmine near the house blended unpleasantly with a musk of soot and old paint. My heart was pounding in my chest, anxiety flying through me with such force that my lungs hurt. I held the flashlight like a club and stilled my breathing to some infinitesimal sibilance. I became aware of a hard knot pressing into my thigh. Car keys. I shifted my weight, extended my right leg with care, reluctant to allow so much as a whisper of tennis shoe on gritty concrete step. I placed the flashlight ever so carefully on the stair below me and inched the keys out, holding onto the bunch to prevent their jingling together. Attached to my key ring was a small ornamental metal disc, maybe the size of a 50-cent piece with no trim, the closest thing to a tool I had access to at this point. I thought with longing of the utility knife, the crowbar and hammer wrapped in plastic and wedged down in the furnace along with the weights. I ran my left hand up along the wood just above my head, feeling for the hinge. It was shaped like an airplane wing, maybe 6 inches long and flat. The screws protruded unevenly, some loosened with age, some gone. I tried using the edge of the disc like a screwdriver, but the heads of the screws had been painted over, and the groove was too shallow now to afford any leverage. I hunched, pushing up. I sensed a little give. Hands shaking with hope, I sorted through the keys, picking out the VW key, which was longer than the rest. I eased it between the hinge and the wood and applied a slight pressure. The hinge yielded a bit. If I could work a little slack into the hinge, maybe the door could be forced up and wrenched free. I pried at it, pressing my lips tight to keep from wheezing with the effort. I paused. All I could hear was my own breathing, labored now as I struggled to loosen the hinge. The wood was pine, old and rotting and soft. I shifted my weight again, trying to give myself more room to work. The basement door creaked. I heard the soft scratch of a shoe on the basement stair. And then I heard the panting, and I knew who it was. Slowly I turned my head to the right. I could see the dim yellow glow from a flashlight, one of those big jobs the size of a lunchbox, throwing out a wide square beam of light. The batteries were weak, washing back only pale illumination. Even so, I recognized the woman I'd met in Florida. Pat Usher, Marty Grice. She wasn't looking good. The tawny hair seemed lifeless, and her eyes were in deep shadow, cheekbones exaggerated by the angle of the light. She swung the beam to the far wall. I held my breath, wondering if there was any chance whatever she'd bypass my hiding place. She moved out of my line of sight for a moment. I didn't dare move. The tension made my bones ache. I could feel my legs start to shake, that uncontrollable trembling made up of stress and muscle cramp and the need to move. It was the drive toward flight turned inward, my body locked in place with no hope of relief. The flashlight beam made a slow turn in my direction, illuminating item by item everything in its path. She was going to pick me up any second, and I did the only thing I could. I launched myself upward like a surfacing whale, pushing the locked doors with such force that they nearly sprung apart. I simply didn't have enough purchase, and she was too quick. I strained, shoving upward again. She must have crossed the room like a shot. My upward motion had taken me almost into an upright position, the doors bulging outward with a cracking sound. My feet were snatched out from under me, and I went down, cracking my head on the concrete step. Her flashlight had careened off to one side, its fading beam aimed ineffectually now at the wall. The light as pointless as a television picture after sign-off. In the thick dark of the basement, there was just enough illumination to work to my disadvantage. I scrambled sideways, pushing to my feet again. She flew at me, nearly climbing my frame, her arms locked around my head. I staggered backward, thrown off balance by the sudden weight. I tried to heave her sideways, skinning her off by bashing with her into the stairs. She was on me like an octopus, tentacles, suckers, and ravaging mouth. I was going down. I tried driving into her with my elbow, but there was no way to connect with enough force to do her any harm. I got one hand up, grabbing her by the hair, tucking forward abruptly so that her own weight carried her to the concrete with a soft grunt. I caught a quick impression of weaponry, warned by a whistling sound, but not soon enough to duck. I heard a sickening crack on impact. She'd come up with what looked like an axe handle, wielded with such force that I felt no pain at all at first. It was like that interval between lightning and thunder, and I wondered if there was some way to gauge the intensity of pain by how many seconds it took to register on the uncomprehending brain. The axe handle came whistling up at me again, and this time I got a hand up, protecting my face, taking the blow on my forearm. I didn't even associate the cracking sound with the pain that shuddered up my frame. My mouth came open, but no sound emerged. She drove down at me again, her eyes bright, her mouth pulled back in something that would pass for a smile among lunatics. I hunched, taking the blow on the shoulder this time. The pain was like heat licking up my side. My fingers closed around the handrail. I hung onto the stairs for dear life. A bright cloud was reducing my vision to a pinpoint, and I knew once the aperture closed, I was dead. I sucked air in, shaking my head, noting with relief that the dark flooded back. I pulled my right fist back. With a low cry, I pushed off, driving forward with everything I had. I connected, and the blow rang all the way back down my arm. I felt the pain arc from my battered knuckles to her face, and she made a low sound I liked. She staggered back, and I launched myself at her, getting a headlock on her that closed her throat. I swung her sideways, keeping her off balance, moving backward at the same time so she couldn't get her feet under her. She was being hanged by the force of her own weight. I braced myself then and concentrated on narrowing the V of my arm where her neck was caught. I heard a loud pop, and for a moment I thought I'd broken her neck. She sagged to the floor. I released my hold to keep from being pulled down on top of her. I looked down at her blankly, and then looked up. Leonard was standing there with a .22 that was now aimed at me. Marty was wheezing.
"You shot me, you fool!"
Her voice was hoarse. Leonard's gaze shifted to her with dumb amazement. I stepped back. The slug had caught her in the side, not a fatal wound, but one that had taught her a little respect. She was on her knees, clutching at herself. She hurt, and she made little mews of outrage and pain. I was winded, still heaving for air, but I felt the strange exhilaration of victory. I had almost killed her. I'd been seconds away from converting her live body to a quiet corpse-like state. Leonard couldn't shoot straight, so he'd felled her himself, thus spoiling the fun. But the battle had been mine. I wanted to laugh until I caught the look on his face. The craziness that had consumed me for the last few minutes drained away, and I realized my troubles were starting all over again. I was dead on my feet. Somehow I'd taken a blow right across the mouth, and I was tasting blood. I felt gingerly to see if a tooth was broken, but everything seemed to be intact. It was a dumb time to worry about the possibility of a cap, but that's what I did. I was trying to pay attention, but it was very hard. I had this weird desire to grovel around on the floor with Marty, the two of us snuffling like wounded animals, looking for a way to crawl off and hide. I would have to go after Leonard soon. Already too much time had passed, and I knew I was losing ground. He was staring at me without expression. I didn't know how to read him anyway. "Come on, Leonard, let's back it in," he said nothing.
I tried to keep my tone conversational, as if I spent part of every day talking guys out of shooting me dead. "I'm tired and it's late. Let's go home. She needs help."
Wrong move. Marty seemed to rouse herself, focusing on him. She didn't represent any kind of threat at this point, but he was teetering on the brink, maybe testing, as I had, the odd new sensation that death-dealing brought.
"Shoot the bitch," she gasped at him. "Shoot!"
I used every last ounce of strength I had, pulling myself together. He fired at me as I moved forward, but by then I was carried along by my own momentum. I yelled, "No!" and kicked him in the kneecap so hard I heard it crack. He dropped, warbling with pain like some kind of weird songbird. The gun skittered off across the floor. I thought Marty would try for it, but she only stared, making no move at all as I bent to retrieve it. I released the cylinder and popped it out. There were 4 more live rounds in the chamber. I snapped it back and made sure the safety was off, turning so that I could keep them both in my line of fire. Leonard was sitting up now, rocking back and forth. He looked at me with momentary venom. I extended the gun, aiming at his face. "I'll kill your ass if you move, Leonard. I've had a lot of practice of late, and I'll drill you right between the eyes." Marty started to cry. It was an odd sound, like an infant with colic. Leonard leaned over and put his arm around her protectively. In that moment, I wished there was someone to comfort me. My left arm was hanging like a piece of wood with a loose connecting pin. I glanced down and saw blood spreading out across my sleeve from a rip the size of a pea. "The sucker shot me," I thought with astonishment. I steadied the gun in my good hand and started yelling for help. It was May Snyder who finally heard me and called the cops. Epilogue. I've been in the hospital now for 2 days with my left arm in a cast. There's an orthopedist coming in this afternoon to assess the x-rays and figure out what kind of rehabilitation I'll need once I get out of here. I've talked to Julia Oxner by phone, and she's invited me to recuperate at her place down in Florida. She promises sunshine and rest, but I suspect she sees it as a chance to set me up as a fourth for bridge. My final bill came to $1,987.35, but she says she won't pay me until I arrive on her doorstep. You gotta watch out for little old ladies. They're tough. Which is more than I can say for myself. I hurt just about every place there is. I look in the mirror and I see someone else's face, puffy mouth, bruised cheeks, the bridge of my nose looking flat. I'm feeling some other kind of pain as well, and I don't know quite what that's made of. I'm closing the file, but the story's not over yet. We'll have to wait and see what the courts do now, and I've learned to be cautious about that. In the meantime, I stare out the window at the palms and wonder how many times I'll dance with death before the orchestra packs it in for the night. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of B is for Burglar by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.